We left 2 Samuel chapter 13. We, for the most part, I completed that chapter, but there were some loose ends which I did not finish. And today is a good day to finish them off. Unfortunately, I can't go to 2 Samuel 14 yet, because 13 is not done yet, because they kind of tie together. So I want to refresh your memories a little bit on chapter 13. We're going to read it again so we don't forget what happened. Refresh your memories a little bit, what we covered, what we talked about, and then hopefully we can finish off the chapter, which, God willing, will make sense. Hopefully today I'll be able to also finish off a small loose end I left after regarding the book of Esther 2 weeks ago, when we covered Esther. There was a minor detail that I had left out, that I left it out on purpose. I'll probably hopefully cover it today. Well, first of all, we're going to go ahead and read this. We'll open up the prayer, of course. This is 2 Samuel chapter 13. Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we ask for your blessing and kindness to be with us today as we learn and worship and study you, God. Please continue to instruct us and we'll always be obedient and follow you to the best of our ability. We trust you and ask for your blessing. In your son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. This is 2 Samuel chapter 13.
Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shemaiah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. And he said to him, "O son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Jonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat and prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat it from her hand.'" So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please, let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight, that I may eat from her hand." Then David sent home to Tamar, saying, "Go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, where he was lying down, and she took dough and kneaded it and made cakes in his sight and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, "Send out everyone from me." So everyone went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the chamber that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon her brother. And when she brought them near him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come lie with me, my sister." She answered, "No, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the outrageous fools in Israel. Now therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." But he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Get up and go." But she said to him, "No, my brother, for this wrong of sending me away is greater than the other you did to me." But he would not listen to her. He called the young man who served him and said, "Put this woman out of my presence and bolt the door after her." Now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. So the servant put her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she wore. And she laid her hand on her head and went away crying aloud as she went. And her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart." So Tamar lived, a desolate woman, in her brother Absalom's house. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. After 2 full years, Absalom had sheep shears at Baal-Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold, your servant has sheep shears. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant." But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go, lest we be burdensome to you." He pressed him, but he would not go, but gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom pressed him until he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. And Absalom commanded his servants, "Mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. When I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear, have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be vigilant." So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. While they were on the way, news came to David. "Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, not one of them is left." Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants who were standing by tore their garments. But Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon alone is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he violated his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king so take it to heart as to suppose that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon alone is dead." But Absalom fled, and the young man who kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, many people were coming from the road behind him by the side of the mountain. And Jonadab said to the king, "Behold, the king's sons have come, as your servant said, so it has come about." And as soon as he had finished speaking, behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept. The king also and all his servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amminadab, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son day after day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead.
Thank you. That was a repetition of the reading of 2 Samuel 13. We covered that, as I mentioned before, 6 weeks ago. I wish to refresh your memory a little bit. What we did cover, because I left the last third of this chapter untalked about. I left it off for reason, well, usually, as most things, lack of time. But that's just a continual thing. Those of you who recall what I did 6 weeks ago, I made a chart, a little handwritten chart. It looks something like these charts, which I'm going to hand out a few of them to you. Just, I only made a few copies, but give you a general idea of what the chart contained. Sorry. This particular chart contained the three comparisons regarding Adam and Eve, David and Bathsheba, and Amnon and Tamar. Now, the chart I wrote on my little board was very condensed and very small, not a whole lot of room, and I write big, so you can read it back there in the back. So I didn't have a whole lot of room. Well, this chart, which, of course, you can all see, which is shown up here on the screen, contains most, not necessarily everything, but most similarities between these two stories. Thank you, sir. As, you know, granted, this chart is not in chronological order. This is the order in which I thought about, so I wrote it down. But these are the similarities, if you noticed. On the sheet paper I handed out, it says the same thing. It points out, of course, there are three columns here. The first one discusses Adam and Eve, and of course also includes the serpent. The middle chart, of course, David and Bathsheba, and the last one, Amnon and Tamar. The similarities we talked about were, all right, well, obviously, all three groups, there was a temptation going on. There was some kind of sin that happened, and all three groups had a lot of similarities. One, for example, in Adam and Eve, we know the serpent being very cunning, right? It actually discusses the serpent was very cunning amongst all the other animals. Well, in David, prior to David and Bathsheba, it discussed that David is also very cunning, back when he was fleeing Saul. Very cunning military man, of course, but still used the term cunning. There aren't very many people in the Bible described as being cunning. Here's three of them. And in Amnon and Tamar, who's described as being cunning? Well, Jonadab is being called being cunning, or very very savvy, or very smart, very manipulating individual. Last time, which I had talked to you, well, there was a temptation which occurred. You obviously have a temptation regarding Eve was obviously tempted. Adam and Eve both sinned together. there was a woman involved with Adam and Eve's story with Ruth regards that temptation. David and Bathsheba, very similar. He was tempted by a woman, just like Adam and Eve were women's involved. Amnon was tempted, in this case, by a woman, the same way. You have, obviously, Adam and Eve sinned together. There was, as opposed to like each individually sinning, they're both sinned as a unit. So did David and Bathsheba, as well as Amnon and Tamar. Granted, it doesn't discuss the beauty of Eve. She was probably very beautiful. We don't know. It does discuss the beauty of both Bathsheba and Tamar. Adam and Eve were discussing a bit forbidden fruit or food from a forbidden tree. Bathsheba and Tamar, with David and Amnon, were both respected for forbidden relationships. The reason I'm going through this is because there were enough similarities that God felt it important to write it down and to make it in a wording that we would detect it. Will you scroll down a little bit? Scroll down a little bit. Thank you. Use the mouse. Scroll on the mouse. Thank you. Thank you, sir. On all three counts, each of the individuals tried to conceal it. Obviously, God found out on all three accounts, but in the last one, David is the one who found out. And that was what actually mattered. The first time with Adam and Eve, God makes the judgment. With David and Bathsheba, David makes the judgment. And with Amnon and Tamar, Absalom makes the judgment. I'm making that point because we're comparing God to David to Absalom today. We're also going to be comparing Satan, David, and Jonadab today. David gets to play a number of roles. It's the nature of God. He doesn't confine you to a single definition in any story. Adam, of course, is dirt. The condemnation that Adam will be over you, Eve, for all your life, all your existence. We don't have a symbol of dirt in David and Bathsheba's story, but we do have one in Amnon and Tamar, that she has put dirt on her head, that Adam, she has now been shamed, that she's now been covered. She has sinned. Of course, Adam and Eve are banished from the garden. David and Bathsheba are banished from their child, not actually a garden place. David has a question, Clark. And you also have Tamar being banished from Amnon.
Possibly there was something of dirt because Bathsheba was taking a bath.
Oh, well, good point. She was being washed clean. Could be. In Adam and Eve, an angel is the one that prevented Adam and Eve from returning to the garden. In David and Bathsheba, of course, death was the preventer. The death prevented them from being reunited with that child. And David, of course, laments regarding that one issue. And, of course, a servant prevented reentry for Tamar. Every instance, the one who is being punished is banished, and they're prevented from coming back. Of course, you have a death. Cain kills Abel. David kills Uriah. Absalom kills Amnon. You scroll down a little further, Richard. Your chart shows the same thing, those of you who have one. Cain, of course, is banished after the murder. David is banished later on, but for the same reason. Your blood on your hands, you will not build my temple. What blood's on his hands? What murder did he commit? Uriah's murder. Makes sense. You have a murderer. You have Absalom banished. Why? Same reason. He murdered his brother. You still have a banishment. There's a little punishment associated with it. You have, of course, like I said, these were not in chronological order. how I thought about it. The serpent is the one who told Eve to sin. David is the one who tells Joab to sin by murdering Uriah for him. Jonadab, of course, tells Amnon to sin. Note the similarities between David, the serpent, and Amnon. This story, like I said, no one character is fixed. God's more dynamic with his literature. The serpent continues to tell Eve that what God told you was incorrect. You're not actually going to die from this food. That's not the case. Well, David tells you, don't think murder is evil. Telling what is good is bad, what is bad is good. That's the problem. And what did Joab say? Well, Joab, after Amnon, of course, killed, tells David, what you've heard is all wrong. You still have somebody saying, I know the truth, and what you've heard is false. Joab turned out to be correct, and guess what? So did the serpent. Eve didn't immediately die, did she? Nor did Adam. So he proved himself right. The serpent proved. He showed her. God was wrong. See, you're still alive. Of course, we don't have an example of that for David, but Jonadab goes out of his way to point out, David, see, the others are wrong. Your sons, save one, are still alive. And of course, we have the ultimate finals that the serpent, of course, betrayed Adam and Eve into death. And I wrote this down, which is not explicitly in your Bible, but is heavily implied. Jonadab betrayed Amnon into death. As you note, when Jonadab talks to David, he says, well, your sons aren't dead. It's just Amnon. That command was given from long ago. Well, if Jonadab knew that, and he was supposed to be really good friends with Amnon, why didn't he tell Amnon? He knew full well this was a setup, Amnon. Jonadab knew it. When the rumors flew, he knew, oh, I know exactly what happened. I know who's dead. Jonadab wasn't actually there. He didn't run. Oh, see, I witnessed it. No, he knew exactly what happened. He knew who was dead. Did he know ahead of time? Probably. So, to my mind, if you know ahead of time and your best friend's going to be murdered and you do nothing about it, are you the murderer? Essentially, you might as well be. You tricked or you betrayed your best friend into death. So my point for making this chart, obviously written out for you, was that, of course, it was more complete, it was more finished. But the objective, as you noted, why would God, as we talked 6 weeks ago, why would God wish to drive bring our attention to these patterns? The pattern with Adam and Eve, matching very similar to David and Bathsheba, matching, of course, very similar to Amnon and Tamar. What would be his objective here? Now, no, God works in patterns of three. Okay? To be a messianic prophecy, it's typically a pattern of three showing up. So, of course, look, he repeated a story three times. Why? What was his objective? What is unique, or why would he want us to read this and say, make the connections or remember back with Adam and Eve and David and Bathsheba during the story of Amnon? Well, what's missing in Adam and Eve's story? There's no more pages, this is the only page. Adam and Eve's story and David and Bathsheba's story. That's not missing in Amnon and Tamar. The stories made one extra character show up in Amnon and Tamar. No, Jonadab was there in the form of Adam and Eve for the serpent. He was there in the form of David and Bathsheba in the form of David, convincing, of course, Joab to kill him. So that's not the new character. Absalom's the new character. God changed the story by saying, okay, you've read this story once, Adam and Eve. You read it again, David and Bathsheba. Read it a third time, Amnon and Tamar. But I've introduced a change. A third story. Absalom. We're going to focus on Absalom next few chapters. He is the Messiah. I'm saying that very bluntly and correctly. He is God's Messiah in this story. David and Absalom, for the next few chapters, are going to be swapping positions back and forth between who is Messiah and who isn't. Because God's objective in the third story was to introduce you someone who is going to do what Messiah is going to do to fix what Adam and Eve went through, to fix what David and Bathsheba went through, and to fix what Amnon and Tamar went through. He introduced you, these are the sins, Adam and Eve. Here's the sins, David and Bathsheba. Here's the sins, Amnon and Tamar. How do we get out of it? Absalom. Absalom's how you get out of it. We're going to study Absalom. Being David's, what, third son? I forgot. I think it's third son. Could be. I forgot who's who. Anyway, he's one of his sons. I think it's his third. I'm pretty sure it's his third son. So that's the part I left out after 13. So let's go to... Oh, first of all, are there any questions so far? I should have asked that. We got a couple. Go ahead, Hank.
There's another story that doesn't fit line by line, but still has a... I keep drawing back to, and that is the rape and defilement of Dinah. And the role of Reuben is very similar to the role of Absalom as well. I see, especially after this plays out where Absalom tries to usurp David and Reuben's downfall and so forth. And, you know, Simeon and Levi,
that's a good
point. Took action against because of their father's
against the men of Shechem. That story, though, you're right, does have certain similarities. Not quite as many as what's listed here by a long shot, but it does have certain similarities. In my personal opinion, which is just my opinion, you can disagree with me all you wish, God teaches through repetition. So his goal is to tell it to you once, I'm going to tell it to you again, I'm going to tell it to you again. You got that? Let's start over again. Tell it to you once again. Tell it to you again. Tell it to you again. Because after this story, we have this repetition of Adam and Eve, David and Bathsheba, Amnon and Tamar. We get the idea of who Messiah is supposed to be. And now God's going to say, okay, chapter 14, let's do it all over again. Chapter 15, let's do it again. 16, let's do it again. He continually repeats it over and over and over, the story of what the Messiah is supposed to do. Each story he does, he usually adds a little bit more information. Allows us to piece together what Messiah is supposed to live through in his life and know ahead of time what we would see when we saw him. Yes, Bill.
Sorry, I forget. But who was, I think it was Bathsheba's grandfather.
Yes. His name, oh crud, I forgot his name. So it's an A.
Wasn't one of the players here?
Not just yet, but yes.
Yeah.
The grandfather, we're going to be adding character to Satan. That sounds bad, but we are. We're adding character to the man, to the being, to it, whatever you call it. And that we know what his capabilities are with Adam and Eve, the cunningness, the ability to demonstrate that he's right and God's wrong. That's a smart individual. That's a very talented individual. So we know that much about him in this case of the serpent. In the case of David, we also learned that even though with Adam and Eve it was, well, no, the fruit won't kill you. You're not going to die. That was a pretty reasonable argument. Well, in David and Joab, we show up and David says, murder's okay. Now, saying eating a piece of fruit you won't die is not as difficult to believe, the person who's hearing it, versus someone saying, murder is not evil. It's harder to make that person believe it. And yet Joab did. Or not believe it, he did it, he obeyed. So it tells us the serpent, or the devil, is more cunning as he goes along. He took a very basic lie and convinced someone to believe it. Then took a much more complicated lie and convinced someone to do it. And then with Yonadab shows up, he takes a very complex lie, an elaborate detail, which a person knows all along and is told during the process this is evil, and convinces them to do it. We're learning more about this individual that we call Satan. Bathsheba's grandfather adds what we find out more regarding who Messiah is going to interact with when he interacts with Satan. We're adding information. God's giving us more details about how cunning this individual actually is. Bathsheba's grandfather plays the story, but not quite yet. I think it's chapter 15 he shows up again. We add more to Satan's character. Right now, we're going to start adding character to Absalom. Because we all think of Absalom, oh, well, he's the one who tried to take over the kingship. Well, he's the one who stuffed all David's wives. He's not a messiah. He's the one who got hung in a tree and they stabbed him a whole bunch of times. He's not a messiah. But he is. That was the objective. God's trying to teach us character. Not that everything David did was a messiah, was he? He was a messianic figure. Did everything David do good? Well, of course not. Well, Absalom's no different. It's not that the people are messiahs, that their character and their actions are going to start matching a messianic prophecies, which we know as what the messiah's life was. So we're going to add stuff to Absalom here. Oh, sorry, any other questions? Okay. So, we already read, obviously, we discussed very great detail the first two-thirds or so of chapter 13. So we're going to pick this story up. Let's see where it is. I'll have to cover this. I'm going to point this, let's pick it up just in verse 23. I'm going to cover this, not because there's any more information here, except one detail, which will show up with, I have to recover a small detail of Esther, which is kind of popping up. I want to cover that today, which I purposely left out when we were talking about Esther. Verse 23, it says, it happened after 2 years they were sharing Absalom's sheep. No, 2 years. Why is the number 2 showing up? Now, we know the number 3 is a messianic prophecy. Death, life, 3, Messiah, we get it. We see all over the place. It's like a shotgun that hits the Bible. You're going to hit it everywhere. It's all over. You hit everything. But number two, surprisingly, shows up more often than you think. Why? This number two shows up here. The number two shows up a little bit later in chapter 14, of course, on the same subject matter. We didn't read chapter 14 today, but I'll point one little detail out to you. It says from 14 in verse 28, this is Absalom afterwards. He comes back from banishment, lives in Jerusalem, 2 full years go by before he sees the same king's face. Will you do me a favor? Will you flip to the Esther page and use the mouse to scroll? That zooms in. You have to use either hold it down and click up and zoom a little bit. The story of Esther two weeks ago, hold the mouse down, hold it down, and drag. Drag up or drag down. Watch. Hold it and drag. That's what I wanted to point out. Hold it and drag. Okay. This is something I purposely glossed over. Forgive me if those of you caught it more curious. And my little chart here, which many of you had, I passed out. I have one more sheet left up here, but you can see it from where you're at, hopefully. Oh, not too close. Okay. That's fine. That's fine. It points out that it says Esther chapter 2, verse 19-20. My little brief description, a condensed version, said, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. The king gave a banquet for Esther, which is Esther's banquets. The maidens were gathered a second time. And of course, Esther said nothing about a Jewish heritage or plots to kill the king. Will you scroll down to the bottom of the document there? Keep going down. That's close enough. It says here, this is Esther chapter 6, verses 1 through 14, Mordecai returns to, of course, the city gate, as we discussed before. Haman was quickly escorted to Esther's banquet. The king asked Esther on the second day of the feast, Esther, where are you? Why, have you ever wondered, why did Esther wait till the second day, to the second feast between Haman and Ahasuerus? Why did she get two banquets? Why did Amnon banish for 2 years? Came back for 2 years without seeing the king. And why did Absalom, Absalom. And why did he wait 2 years before dealing with Amnon? Why is number two showing up? By the way, this is not the only time number two shows up. It shows up a few more times as well. The number two means something to God. It's not just number three. We think of the 3 days, 3 nights, Messiah's resurrection. Well, number two, you'll notice, seems to be an event or a waiting period. She waits two. Absalom waits for two. She gets two banquets and still waits. Doesn't tell anybody anything. Two is a waiting period. So something about Messiah and his resurrection aspect, there is a period of waiting for two. Two what? We don't know, but two. Before one, he gets vengeance upon those who committed sin upon him. Or two, gives forgiveness to those who are needing to be forgiven. What could that possibly mean to us? Possibly 2,000? It's possible. There is obviously God's going out of his way to point out there is a two built into this three, as we are accustomed to always looking for. There's a sequence of waiting. Something waits for 2 years or two period of time. It's always been, not always been, most have been 2 periods of time, or in the case of Esther's, two events. Two things have to wait. Well, what happens after two? The flood happened after two, that's true. What else happens after two? Hank?
Elisha.
Elijah and Elisha come in pairs of two, witnesses. Second coming. There's something else I want to point out to you after two. What happens with Haman during Esther's time after two? But what was he thinking? He was relaxed. Things were going all his way. He had nothing to worry about. Getting drunk. Having a good time. What happens to Amnon after two? He's relaxed. Nothing to worry about. Life's going good. He's drunk. What did Messiah warn us about when he returns? People will be relaxed, nothing to worry about, drinking, all's good. There's a time which you're not expecting it. And what's actually occurring in Esther's event? They're all supposed to be relaxed and drinking and eating. It's an objective state. There is a period of time to wait until you are not ready. Yes, Tammy.
Although there are people, like with the story of Haman, he was given at least some warning.
Some, yes.
His wife gave him
that warning ahead of time.
And if you think about the second coming, yeah, it talks about the days of Noah, feasting, drinking, everything
right.
else.
And they're given
a
warning
time,
still.
At the same time, we still do have the warning.
Yes.
And maybe in this story with the whole thing with Amnon and Absalom and that feud that they were having, Amnon should have had some warning.
Exactly. Because, no, they didn't speak for 2 straight years, wouldn't even look at each other. Clearly, Amnon knew Absalom doesn't like me anymore. We're not in good graces. Clearly, Jonadab, which of course kept his mouth shut for his own reasons, knew that Absalom and Amnon didn't like each other anymore. So we know this period of two corresponds to some kind of relax, your guard let down. You don't worry about it anymore. All's going well, and that's when it matters. That's when the big event occurs. So that's what I pointed out to you. I left it out for a reason, because I want to talk about it in this chapter, because that's where the two kind of tied in. So I left out the Esther's 2 weeks ago for a reason. Yes, Dave.
One more thing with the Israelites. They were warned twice of doom or judgment. They were given the first warning, the second warning, and then the third thing came to pass. Just like in the Harbinger series that this gentleman had done recently,
mm-hmm.
bringing out those things and our parallels with Israel as a nation here in America.
Mm-hmm.
We've been given two warnings. The third thing is a judgment, but there's like the two warnings.
There's a period of time
after that, yeah, and then all of a sudden, whammo.
All right, did at any point in time Amnon go to his brother and say, I am terribly, horribly sorry?
No. It doesn't say that.
Did Haman, before he got his judgment, ever go to Esther and say, oh, I'm horribly, terribly sorry, or Mordecai, I'm horribly, terribly sorry? None of the moments they had the time to say, oh, I need to change my way. Did anybody ever do anything about it? They waited till the guard was down. So, thank you for humoring me. I wanted to add that so I can get a chance to talk about it. The only other thing about Esther that I also purposefully left out, which I told my mother last week, as we had pointed out, you know, the characters of the story, who they all represented in many ways, I left out Vashti on purpose, because Vashti, according to the story, the way it's written out, appears to be Levi, biblical priesthood. For the 7-day feast is given, commanded to come forth in all of its glory and splendor. And it says, I want to do my own thing. And God says, I will remove you completely. I'll replace you with one better. We know that story. We know the idea. And also her own garments she's wearing happens to be very, very similar to what the Levitical priest is supposed to be wearing. So, anyway, minor detail. Other stuff. By the way, I tied my thing today, loose ends. I'm closing up loose ends today. So, I'm purposely not going much beyond this. I hope you don't mind. So we read, okay, well, let's discuss this about it. I already answered, what does this tell us about Satan? We're adding, you can scroll back to the other page there, Richard. Thank you. We already had a detail. We learned that Satan seems to be adding, or God's pointing out, that Satan's more clever or more devious than we like to think about him as. He's overpowering, overwhelming. But who can actually convince you that murder's good? And who can convince you that premeditated rape of some disgusting, incestuous thing is a good thing? It's hard to, during the process, you're being told it's wrong. It's hard to convince somebody, and yet he obviously successfully does so. So we learn something about Satan. Well, what do we learn about Absalom now? What do these stories teach us about Absalom, who is our messianic figure for this portion of the story? Yes, Ellie.
His sister. He covers his sister.
He did cover his sister. Let's see. Will you scroll up a couple of... thank you. That's far enough. I want to point out something here. As I gloss over slightly, but I did mention it. On Adam and Eve, God judged Adam and Eve. With David and Bathsheba, David, although unknowingly, judged David and Bathsheba. with Amnon and Tamar, Absalom judges each of them. Now, what judgment does Absalom give to each? To Tamar, he says, you do not need to cover your head. You are now covered by me. I will protect you. You are my child now. Mercy. Gave compassion. Is she technically contaminated, worthy of death? Yeah. Incest. Whether willingly or not, it's incestuous. You are not touchable. That is a death sentence in the Torah, whether you were consenting or not. Technically, that's the case, but what did he do? Was it? He gave her complete compassion and took her in. Forgave it. Because he knew, by the letter of law, she's guilty, but the mercy of law, she wasn't. What did he do to Amnon? Death penalty. For obviously, rape, incest, a lot of variety of things, but it all combined together and all shoved into it. But he sends death penalty. So in the story, we're seeing that God is being compared to David, who's being compared to Absalom. So Absalom is acting as God. He's acting as a Messiah. It says, I know that, yes, you are guilty of sin. I know that, yes, you are supposed to be dead for it. I know that you need compassion and mercy. You granted it. I know the evil person who connived this evil thing, I'm going to kill by his own hand. Well, sort of. He has his servants do it, but same difference. Yes, Anne.
Absalom is like God in that he's long-suffering because he didn't do the judgment right away.
That's very true. You're right. You're right. Absalom waited. He waited because he knew the timing wasn't right. Who knows timing better than God? No one. Rose.
Well, Tamar pleaded her case before her brothers. She said, you shouldn't be doing this to me. This is wrong. And she did not consent to it.
Right.
He threw her down.
Exactly.
He overpowered her and threw her down. So I can see where mercy would step in there.
Yeah, it's valid.
She did not jointly go with that idea.
Of course. You're absolutely right. And he saw that. So, okay, I've heard your case. I understand where you're coming from. I know what you just went through. Mercy is warranted. This should not be, although technically it's an incestuous problem, you are going to be covered. You will not be punished for this. Meaning any beyond what you've already went through. Yes, Ellie.
Absalom was going to become the new king,
yep,
too. Because David was out and Absalom was in.
Yep. It will be. That's cheating because you're going two chapters ahead. So, okay. Let's continue on here. So, of course, these are additions to characters that are going to be talked more and more about over the next few chapters. Well, there's other details you notice that seem to be missing. Because if I'm going to have to believe that Absalom is some kind of Messiah, he better do a whole lot more than just this. And this is not enough for me to believe that at all. I mean, yeah, he's like a guy who is compassionate toward his sisters, all it looks like to me. Well, God's smarter than that, and I'm sure he knew that ahead of time, so he wrote it out ahead of time. Chapter 14, it adds more details to Absalom. We're not going to read chapter 14 yet, but there's stuff I want to point out that we're missing. For me to believe that Absalom is going to be a king, I want him to raise from the dead. If I spell Absalom, I spelled it once. A-L-O-M goes up from dead. I have terrible penmanship. Oh well. It's a dead person, dead thing. I want to see him raised from the dead. Not necessarily physically, but I want to see the symbolism there. What else do I want to see? I want to see him become a king. Don't I? Because Messiah, if he's going to be the answer to these three scenarios with Adam and Eve, David and Bathsheba, Amnon and Tamar, he's going to answer that. I want him to answer it. That requires a king who has the ability to give compassion, which we'll read about in a couple chapters. So he has to be compassionate and be king. So, I'm going to abbreviate. So C for compassionate, K for king. Forgive me, but I'm a terrible speller. I know I'd misspell compassionate if my life depended on it. Okay. So what else do we want to know about Absalom? Let's see here. If I'm going to believe that Absalom is somehow going to fix this scenario, I want him to die with some friends. I want him to die with two other people. Why not? Messiah did. Am I fair in asking that request? If I want a picture, and this is going to be one of the most complete altar pictures God ever wrote in the Tanakh, Shai the Messiah himself, I want to be really, really complete. I want to see two friends. Now, most of you have probably read the story of Absalom and thinking to yourself, wait a minute. There are no two friends that die with him. What's Daniel talking about? How is he going to pull that one off? Well, God's smarter than that. Because was Messiah friends with the two guys that died with him? No. Oh, okay, so let's take back the friends. He's died with just two other people. Well, God's smarter than that, too. Both individuals that die, one believes in Messiah and one does not, right? Okay, granted. So the people who have to die with him, there has to be some kind of a resurrection, too. To go with it. Because that's, if you believe in Messiah, you don't actually, death's not supposed to have power over you. Okay, God will make this more difficult. Of the two people who die, I want one of them at least to come back with Absalom. Stay tuned. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat. We will see you guys when we cover chapter 14 in a couple of weeks.